This is The Guardian.
Regrets, I had a few, but then again, too few to mention. I did what I had to do. I saw it through.
I'm Regid Ahmed.
And I'm Jonathan Yeroshelmi.
And this is Decoding America, a new podcast from Guardian Australia. Well, Jonathan, Donald Trump sending a message, perhaps, by posting Sinatra on his social media, especially as he struggles to get Iran to play to his tune.
Yeah, we're hours away from a ceasefire expiring and a possible return to fighting. Donald Trump is seemingly desperate to wrap up this whole excursion. He just doesn't appear to know how.
We are going to talk about all of that and more, Jonathan, including a horrific mass shooting that happened in Louisiana. There's a real juxtaposition there with how that coverage compares to what's going on in the war. But first, it is this inescapable fallout from this conflict with Iran. And then Donald Trump posts a full Sinatra song to his feed.
Yeah, I want to take you inside the conspiracy-drenched world of U.S. politics in 2026, where the president sharing a Sinatra ballad online at close to midnight on Saturday ends up being imbued with all sorts of hidden meanings and messages. It was a really strange thing, wasn't it? Because, you know, many people probably know that song, but there's some lyrics in there that people were reading into a bit.
Like, yes, there were times I'm sure you knew when I bit off more than I could chew.
That one stood out to me as well. Yeah. But I was looking at the way people were commenting on this online, and a lot of people were saying, this means something. Is he about to resign? Is he about to restart the war? Is he about to bomb another country? What does this mean?
And the one we started with, regrets, I've had a few. I do wonder if he kind of regrets going into war with Iran. Do we have any evidence of that?
Well, look, I think to a certain extent, Donald Trump has to be allowed to post a song by Frank Sinatra without us deciding that it means all these different things. But it does go to a point, doesn't it? You know, we're so used to discounting so much of his commentary now because people say that it's just too outlandish, that he's just being Trump, he's too bombastic. But his words are imbued with real meaning, often beyond his own comprehension. Just because of the role he inhabits, Donald Trump, when he says something, the world listens. And that brings us to Iran.
It does matter, as you say, when the president posts something, no matter what it is, we're all looking for messages. And part of it is because of how chaotic the negotiations have been around the Iran war and any peace deal.
Yeah, let's just remind our listeners. So last time we spoke, there had been negotiations in Islamabad. J.D. Vance was leading them, and they had broken up after 21 hours without a deal. Since then, we had the blockade of the Strait. We had more chaos in negotiations. And the latest is that negotiations might resume in Islamabad between Iran and the United States, but it's been a real mess getting there. And just yesterday, we were reporting on how authorities in Islamabad were halting public transport and heavy goods vehicles. They were putting cordons outside this Serena Hotel, this very fancy hotel in Islamabad where the negotiations would likely take place. And all the guests were being told to leave this hotel just in case negotiations happened. And reminder, they didn't know whether they were going to be.
I mean, we don't mean to trivialize what's happening with the war in terms of reflecting on a Sinatra song and what it might mean. A lot of people are probably feeling like they're being jerked around a bit. I know on the weekend when we got news that the Strait of Hormuz might be opened by Iran, there was this sense that, oh, God, maybe it's all over. And then Donald Trump says, no, 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 my blockade is still on. It's just that back and forth, back and forth. It's exhausting.
Yeah, and you're right to highlight that because that's a really important point. So at this point, I think it's useful to understand how these negotiations work between major powers, between different countries, and between sworn enemies like Iran and the US. So they're really, really complicated processes, and they basically involve sequences. So it's about building trust and confidence. So, for instance, we saw Iran wanted a ceasefire in Lebanon. And last week, Donald Trump told Benjamin Netanyahu and said publicly that Israel would no longer be bombing Lebanon, and he was enforcing this ceasefire, it seems. After that, Iran said, okay, we will partially open up the Strait of Hormuz, through which 20% of the world's energy, oil, moves through in normal times. That's really important to the world economy. And I think the expectation after that is that then Donald Trump would give something else, and it would be this tit for tat, building confidence, giving things up.
That's how negotiations are supposed to go.
And it's how it would normally happen in the lead up to a negotiation. And I think from the Iranian side, they wanted to see the blockade lifted. Instead, what we got was Trump saying, the strait is completely open. The blockade will remain. There will be no freeing up of Iranian frozen assets. And most importantly, Iran has agreed to hand over their stockpile of highly enriched uranium. It was like all of Donald Trump's Christmases had come at once.
And Iran said...
Well, and from Iran's perspective, they said, what?
Yeah.
Because from what everything we understand, they hadn't agreed to any of this. Donald Trump was making policy on the hoof here. And we don't even know if this was something he was saying, you know, agreement he was making with his State Department advisors, with his National Security Council. It just seemed like he was making up policy. And so it's perhaps not surprising then that the Iranians said, actually, no, and we're closing the strait again, and we're not attending these talks. Now, things have cooled down a bit since then, but it gives you an idea of how important it is that these negotiations are handled delicately.
It's worth remembering that Trump did say at the start of the war, this is going to last 4 to 5 weeks. We're now about 7 to 8 weeks in. And separate to what is happening in Trump's mind, under the surface, there's commentary that the White House is lacking in some sort of understanding of Iran as a country, and that's why they can't get anywhere.
I think that's a really important point, because if you speak to any experts in this, understanding Iran is really important, especially at this moment where its leadership has been broken up. The Ayatollah Khamenei was killed on the first day of this war. There is, we're told, another Ayatollah leading the country. But it seems like a lot of the decision-making is quite broken. And there is a split between the more traditional parts of the Iranian government, the foreign ministry, and then the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps. These are the more fundamentalist wing of the Iranian government, who perhaps are more unwilling to bend to Trump's will. And when you hear from experts in this, negotiators who have spoken to Iran in the past, they say that you have to be really aware that you're speaking to, yes, negotiators, but you're also speaking to a different wings of Iranian politics back in the country, and you're speaking to the country at large, and all of them have differing things that they want. And so it's really important that you try and kind of find a way through this very difficult path. Federica Mogherini, she was the EU negotiator in the 2015 nuclear deal, and she was writing about Trump's negotiations last week, and she gave a really interesting insight. And she said that when they were negotiating, they understood that the Iranian negotiators operate within their country's factional politics, and that compromises would need to reflect what each side could concede without losing domestic support. And she, from, you know, her view was that the American team has been built around personnel and political proximity to Trump rather than expertise.
There is a lot of chatter that J.D. Vance and Steve Witkoff just don't really appreciate that element. But there's also some reporting that Trump's impulsiveness is something the White House is sort of trying to deal with, almost keeping him out, because we talked about leaks last week. It appears there's been some more.
Yeah, it's interesting that the more this war goes along, the more leaking we seem to be seeing from this White House. I think you're referring to a really interesting article in the Wall Street Journal this week talking about Trump at war and the way that he was operating. And what it found, what some of these insiders were telling the Wall Street Journal, was that when he's sending out these tweets and, you know, Truth Social media posts saying things like, we're going to destroy a civilization or open the effing straits, you bastards, he seems to be doing that without any consultation with the wider security apparatus within the White House. And instead, he seems to be making up that policy and improvising it, thinking that, you know, he can scare or be seemed he can seem unstable, and that will somehow bring the Iranians to the table.
Meanwhile, there's an architecture within the US government that kind of has to deal with the reality of the situation. So you're starting to see that sort of rub up against each other. Just before we move on, I do wonder, especially as Donald Trump continues to talk about getting some sort of nuclear deal, and in the end, what he wants is a better deal than what Obama got. And that's the only way that he will walk away from this conflict.
Yeah, that, I mean, it's difficult to tell, but that seems to be the yardstick that he's measuring it against. Mm. We saw overnight he posted on his Truth Social account that his deal would be so much better than the JCPOA. That's the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action that Barack Obama and several other countries negotiated back in 2015. And that deal only covered Iran's nuclear program. It didn't go into the proxies like Hezbollah. It didn't go into their ballistic missile capability. And that it received criticism for that, and it received criticism for it being it only lasting a certain period. It would run out eventually. But I think when you speak to the people and you hear from the people involved in those negotiations, they felt that was a realistic starting point. They felt they could make that deal and then Iran would open up and maybe go from there. It appears Donald Trump wants to do everything at once.
Meanwhile, alongside all of this is how Americans feel about it, what's happening to the economy. I mean, do Americans need the war to be over just as much as we do here in Australia?
I think there's a view that Americans are starting to feel the pinch. If you look at some inflation figures that came out in March, petrol prices specifically surged 21% in March. That's the fastest rate since 1967, fastest rate in decades. And that, we know, would just kind of stream throughout the economy, affecting everything. Consumer sentiment is plunged to a record low in America. That is a damning backdrop for Donald Trump, who ran on making America affordable again. That was such a big part of his campaign in 2024, that he would be looking at the domestic economy, that he was worried about people's back pockets, and he was, you know, going to make life easier for them.
And that's what people are saying. I heard on NPR some swing voters in Georgia that they spoke to who voted for Trump in 2024. And one of them said he didn't like the war in Iran, but he said, what happened to bringing down the price of eggs?
Yeah, it's so interesting, isn't it? It's in the last couple of months, we've got so many of these stories of people who voted for Trump who apparently are feeling that, you know, they were led up the garden path a bit. The Atlantic spoke to a series of Trump voters in Arizona recently. That's such an important state for American politics. It's one of the kind of key swing states. And one of the voters said, when Trump opens his mouth, three quarters of what he says is lies. That's someone who voted for him and is now feeling regretful of that.
And I was looking at an NBC poll on Sunday. 67% and 68% of adults somewhat or strongly disapprove of the way Trump is handling the war. There's bad feeling out there around it. And I think Trump knows that. Do you think he's picking up on that?
I think he understands that the economy is the thing that will make or break his presidency, as it does for most presidents. I think he understands that going into the midterms, which, let's remember, are really important elections coming up for America in November, that will decide the makeup of Congress, the legislative chambers. He understands that people will be looking at whether their lives are better than they were 2 years ago. They'll be looking at whether they can afford what they could afford a couple of years ago. What I think he's not seeing is the things external to the war that his presidency has brought to working class voters, blue collar voters who would have supported Trump. Things like, you might remember last year, the Republicans passed the One Big Beautiful Bill. This was this huge spending bill that Trump had been backing. Mm. And it included massive cuts for healthcare, massive cuts for Medicare, massive cuts for other social safety net programs. We're going to see more cuts to the Affordable Care Act. And we're also going to see things like the president has rescinded an executive order that raised the minimum wage for federal contractors. That's going to affect about 300,000 people. So as well as the general picture of the economy, you've got all these other little areas biting at the government things that people really rely on.
And people see that juxtaposition, I think, between cuts to services and then requests for funding for the war. I thought it interesting that Donald Trump contradicted to his own energy secretary, who's been talking about how gas prices might not come down to pre-Iran war levels until next year. And he told The Hill that's not correct. As soon as the war is over, prices will fall. I mean, he wouldn't be pushing back on that if he didn't have a sense that the American public is concerned.
Yeah, and I think what we're seeing is that, you know, with inflation higher than it was under Biden, with voters blaming him specifically for the petrol price rise, he's going to be doing everything he can do to fight back against this kind of cost of living chaos that he's been handed.
We're talking about how Americans are feeling at home, and all of this coverage of the Iran war is kind of distracting from some other really key things that are happening in America that have nothing to do with the war, such as gun violence. We saw a really awful shooting over the weekend in Louisiana.
Yeah, so this was in a town in Louisiana where a mass shooting event, a single event, 8 children were killed in one shooting. Their ages were from 1 to 14 year old. You know, it's just an awful thing to see.
Let's just have a listen to a local councilwoman react to it and get a sense of how difficult it's been for a lot of people.
I think about this community and what this community has lost. And I don't have the words to give you, and I'm sorry.
It was really deeply felt in Louisiana, but not as much coverage as you'd think.
No, it's interesting, isn't it? If we imagine something like this happening where 8 people killed, 8 children killed in a single event, if that happened anywhere else in the world, I think we would expect that to be wall-to-wall coverage for days. It is just such an outrageously awful thing to see. But unfortunately, in America, it's not uncommon. So I was looking at something called the Mass Shooter Database yesterday. This is a group of people who do some amazing work trying to track the number of shootings in America. There's been 140 mass shootings in 2026 so far. We're only in April. So that's defined as 4 or more people shot in a single event. And since this shooting yesterday in Louisiana, there have been another 4 mass shootings just since then.
And this one particularly, you would think there's would be more of a conversation around, because police are describing it as a domestic disturbance, that there's a domestic violence link to it. And there's a uniquely American term for something like this called family annihilation. I have never heard that term until now.
So we know now that the father of 7 of the victims was the shooter. And the shooter's brother-in-law had said he'd been upset after his wife requested a divorce. And yes, since 1980, the US has had this term, family annihilation. And what we see is that often when these events occur, and they are these domestic incidents, even if they're as horrific as this is, with as many victims and as many young people, the media, Americans more generally, seem to view them as isolated tragedies, things that we could just do nothing to fix, because they are a domestic incident. They seem to put them into separate basket to random mass shootings at schools where, you know, a student goes in and just starts firing. Perhaps because the randomness of that makes people feel like they could have been a victim. For whatever reason, these domestic incidents just get put in another basket. But it's really interesting. The Indianapolis Star, a local paper, in July 2023, did an investigation, and they found that these sorts of incidents, domestic violence shootings, they're happening across the US every 5 days on average. So they are not isolated incidents that people can just ignore.
What really stood out for me was you're seeing in Australia and in the UK for a number of years this real conversation around gender-based violence, because I was reading that an overwhelming majority of the cases of family annihilation involve a male killer. I just don't see that conversation being had in America. And I just wonder how much of that is the gun rights issue, and how much of that is there just isn't space to talk about really important things.
I think it's hard, isn't it? If you think about incidents like this when they happen in other countries, if we think back to the Port Arthur massacre in Australia or even the Bondi shooting more recently, these events should force changes. They should force countries to rethink how they're operating, whether it be gun laws, whether it be, you know, background checks on people, on criminals and things like that. They should force the political system to do something.
And they often do.
And we've seen the changes happen here in Australia. We've seen the gun laws change. We've seen other changes more recently in after the Bondi attack. And whether you like those changes or not, something happened.
But you just don't see that in the US. It's like blink and move on.
I think that there's a really difficult thing with the polarization in that country. So there are certain issues which we can look at as a society, as a community, as a country, and say, this is an issue that we can't even argue about. No one is arguing about the efficacy of antibiotics, and nobody's arguing about, you know, whether astronomers are giving us the right data from their work. But there are some issues that, despite all the evidence pointing to the fact that America experiences more of these kinds of events than any other country, and at the same time has the most lax gun laws of any developed country, I think many people in Australia and around the world put those two bits of information together and say, ah, there must be a connection there. But there's something that's happened in America's polarization that means people are unwilling to accept that data in front of their eyes.
And we were hearing Tabitha Taylor there, the local councilwoman. I don't think we could say that it doesn't hit home, that it's not an awful thing that Americans want dealt with, because every time something like this happens, there's a lot of grieving that goes along with it.
Absolutely. But whether that grieving turns into policy change, I remember covering the Sandy Hook shooting in 2012. You probably remember this as well. We were working together at the time.
Yeah.
This was an awful event where 26 people were killed, most of them children between the ages of 6 and 7 years old, in a shooting in Connecticut. It was a random shooting in a school, and it was an extraordinary moment because it felt like this was it. This was where America was going to draw
a
line
in the sand.
Exactly. This was a watershed moment. Barack Obama was president. He just entered his second term, and he said he was going to make gun control a key tenet of his second term, and he created a task force headed up by the vice president, Joe Biden. And the centerpiece of this was a piece of legislation to ban assault weapons. They had been banned broadly in the 1990s. That ban had lapsed, as well as banning high-capacity magazines. So these are bits of ammunition that you can put into a normal weapon, and instead of having, I don't know, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 bullets, you have 20 bullets. And the attacker in Sandy Hook School was using one of these. There was a huge amount of work trying to get that legislation passed. It failed in the Senate. It failed. And I think after that, people looked at what was happening and thought, if we cannot pass what is quite mild and meek gun legislation, if we can't pass that because 20 children have been killed in a shooting in Connecticut, then what will force us to do that?
It's a good point that perhaps some people have almost given up on gun rights legislation change. All right, well, let's go to a break. When we come back, remember the Democrats? What lessons are they learning as they look towards the crucial midterms?